Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Naomi Pullen. Naomi is Assistant Professor of Early Modern British History at the University of Warwick in the UK, and we're going to be talking to Naomi about her new book, Female Friends and the Making of Transatlantic Quakerism, 1650 to 1750, just published by Cambridge University Press. Naomi, congratulations on your book and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Crawford, and thank you for having me here today and letting me talk about my book.
Well, we're looking forward to doing that. Before we talk about the book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, so as you said, I'm an assistant professor in early modern British history at the University of Warwick. And I've had quite a long history with Warwick. I completed my undergraduate and postgraduate qualifications there, and then I moved on to do a Leverhulme early career fellowship at St John's College in Cambridge, and I moved back to Warwick again in 2018.
And does it feel like a homecoming?
Yeah, it really does, actually, because very much my training in history at Warwick was very much in the social history of Britain, and I feel that that's really where my research interests lie now, and it's a great place, I think, to be working and teaching. And my research itself centres on the gender and religious history of the early modern British Atlantic, and my research today really has focused on uncovering the experiences and identities of women in Britain and North America. So, yeah, Warwick's a great department for being able to explore and focus on those things.
Great. And so many of those themes come out in this book, Don't Leave Female Friends in the Making of Transatlantic Quakerism. What's the background to this book, Naomi?
So I guess really the book, or at least like the makings of the book, began when I was a postgraduate student at Warwick. And I found myself drawn to the early Quakers, and I'm sure we'll talk about the origins of the movement a bit later. But I was really, really struck by how the early Quakers seemed to be defying traditional gender conventions, because women were able to preach and act as ministers. And the more I uncovered about the early Quakers, the more I was really amazed to find that women were writing and publishing on things like the theological equality of the sexes and undertaking independent missionary work, which started to lead me to question really what life was like for more ordinary Quaker women, perhaps women who may have converted to the movement because of the fact that their husbands had decided to convert, or what it was like for women whose husbands were traveling and spending long times undertaking missionary service. So that's really was the starting point, really, for my PhD at Warwick.
So tell us, how did the Quaker movement begin? Who were some of the early leaders? Where was it based? How did it grow? What kind of numbers were involved?
Yeah, so the origins of Quakerism are a little bit unclear, but it's largely been attributed to a man called George Fox, who was a shoemaker's apprentice from Leicestershire. And the movement really evolves out of the very turbulent moment in British history, the English Civil Wars. And it's in the late 1640s that George Fox starts to sort of experience a moment of, I guess, a spiritual crisis, and he starts to undertake and move around the northern counties of England, trying to sort of create some kind of theology. And what eventually emerges is a belief in the what they call an inward light. And it's this idea that everyone has access to the word of God. So you don't need any kind of minister or intermediary to intervene. And anyone is entitled to this spiritual revelation. And that included women and also people of any kind of social status. So it's quite a radical theology. And the message of early Quakerism is then spread through a number of very charismatic Quaker leaders. So that includes George Fox, but also people like the infamous James Naylor. And James Naylor's an interesting character, because he rather ridiculously rides into Bristol on a donkey with women, a group of women saying Hosanna, Hosanna, and he's arrested and charged with blasphemy, as you might expect. But there are a number of other figures involved, including people like George Whitehead, Ed, and a Quaker that becomes a martyr called James Parnell. And the movement spreads through essentially itinerant missionary service, so people travelling around and engaging with a range of groups of people, and it becomes a very rapidly growing religion. It's been estimated that by 1660, which is only really about 10 years after the movement really fully begins, that there are around 60,000 Quakers in England. So it becomes a very popular movement. It's got that sort of early evangelical charisma, really. It's a heavily persecuted movement. Predictably, because the Quakers are advocating such unusual and radical ideas, and also undertaking quite dramatic activities. So, for example, many of the early Quakers run through the streets naked as a sign of their spiritual purity. Mm. They're really sort of quite shunned by wider society, and they do also want to try and spread their mission and their words further abroad as well. So we have a number of Quakers traveling to different parts of Europe, to Ireland, and to the North American colonies and the West Indies. And then in the 1680s, a charter is granted to to an early Quaker leader called William Penn, which goes on to become Pennsylvania in 1681. And that is really modelled on Quaker ideas and values. It's a very tolerant religious community, and a large number of Quakers then go over to North America to settle. And I think there's estimates that by around 1775, there are 100,000 Quakers living in North America, which by that point is a much larger figure than the number of Quakers who are living in England at that time, which I think had decreased to about 20,000.
The names you've mentioned so far, Naomi, would all be the names of men. How important were women in these early years of the growth of the Quaker movement?
Yeah, so unusually for a movement of this time, women are incredibly prominent figures within early Quakerism. There's one woman in particular called Margaret Fell, who goes on to marry the Quaker leader George Fox, and she's really regarded as being the mother of Quakerism. She's a very prominent figure. She writes on subjects such as the ability of women to speak in church. But because, as I said, the Quakers advocate an idea of spiritual equality, it does mean that women are also able to undertake missionary work, and that's regardless of their domestic obligations. So we have women like, there's a servant called Mary Fisher who travels to Turkey to try and convert the great Turk himself. And there's also two women who are quite famously held in captivity in Malta by the Maltese Inquisition, called Catherine Evans and Sarah Cheevers, who had been trying to travel to Alexandria on a missionary movement there. So anyone who essentially feels a call, this sort of overwhelming feeling that they need to spread the Quaker message, are able to travel and preach. So women are quite prominent and quite visible figures of the early movement. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why the movement gets such a bad reputation and why it is so heavily persecuted in those early years, because it seems to be giving undue authority, I think, to its female members. And then that debate about what status and what position women should have within the movement as it starts to evolve and become more established, mm-hmm. Becomes a really central issue for Quakers to try and address.
So Quakers, in social terms, are quite a revolutionary movement. Almost, I was going to say genderless, that's an exaggeration, but certainly a downplaying of male-female distinctives and an opening up of opportunity for example, women prophets. But as the Baptist movement and other new religious movements of the period evolve over time, they move from what sociologists might call sect to denominational status and become more conservative as time goes on, don't they? Do we see the same thing happening among the Quakers?
So that is one of the central questions that underpins my book. And it's certainly one that scholars of the movement in the past have argued. So very much the gender histories of the movement from the 1980s and the 1990s have suggested that once Quakerism becomes more established, so when it moves from its first to its second and third generations, the roles that are available to women are much more limiting and much more conservative. Mm-hmm. So they would argue that the shift in the public roles available to women moves from this kind of idea of them undertaking, say, undertaking missionary travel or participating in radical prophecy, to being much more focused around the home and the Quaker community. And one of the objectives with my book was really to show that I don't think the decline of women's status associated with sect to church is necessarily a valid view. As the Quaker movement evolves, there becomes much more of a state, much more of a valorization conversation of the household and the importance of the household in advancing Quaker values and Quaker beliefs. And it therefore gives the mother a very important place within the Quaker movement. And I think it's been estimated by the historian Richard Van that by 1750, 90% of Quakers are the children of Quakers. Mm-hmm. So the movement is no longer really making efforts to convert, to make new converts. The importance is really on ensuring that the children of current converts are adhering to Quaker beliefs and Quaker testimonies and values.
Your book shows that the idea of the ideal Quaker household is something that's always been policed and monitored, especially in that first chapter where you give lots of examples of Quaker women who are often wives and mothers leaving their families, sometimes for years at a time, to go on missionary expeditions. Who was left in charge of the household, and to what extent did the household come under the governance or the care of the Quaker disciplinary organisation, the meeting system, when these women were away from home?
Yeah, so it's actually a question that I've been trying to answer, and one that I guess I can only infer from some of the sources that have survived. So in theory, if a Quaker mother was undertaking missionary work, then it would be accepted that her husband would take over and be the primary carer of the family in her absence, and it was expected that husbands and wives were to respect one another if they did feel that they had this spiritual calling. And I think of it's hard to tell exactly how this would have worked in practice. I think from some of the sources I've looked at, it's clear that grandparents had a very important role in assisting in childcare, particularly, I think, if a husband is working, he can't necessarily do both those roles. There's also, I think, older siblings would have also helped and supported the family whilst a mother was absent. And we also know that when Quaker ministers did feel a calling to undertake spiritual work abroad, they would have to go to their local monthly meeting and essentially declare that they had this calling to travel, and in theory they would then have to return a month later and say whether that calling still existed, and then it would be scrutinized by other like levels within the meeting structure. So it would then go up to a quarterly meeting, and they would also try and discern whether this calling was genuine. And then they would grant a certificate for a minister to undertake travel, and it would tell other meetings that there was an expectation, I think, to support the minister, but also to say that this is an approved missionary, and that what they were doing was supported by their community. And I think in going through that process, it also meant that meetings then had a kind of unofficial role in assisting the family during that absence. So it might be that they had to provide some financial assistance if there was any kind of loss of income as a result of the travel. Or it might be that they did have to overlook and care for the children of absent Quakers whilst they were gone.
Is one of the paradoxes, I think, of your book, and your book draws this out in a really brilliant way, is the sense or is the sense of how what's initially an incredibly charismatic and almost individualistic movement becomes within a couple of generations very demarcated by a hierarchy of meetings, of committees, which control in some quite surprising ways the details of individuals' lives. Chapter 2 is about the women's meetings, how they developed as separate committee structures, and also the different ways in which they interacted with other bodies, but also the differences that they had geographically. You talk in that chapter about how some meetings in some locations were very focused on marriage, others were interested in household arrangements, or even what women should wear. Can you tell us a little bit about the women's meetings, how they evolved, how they varied over space, and what their purpose was?
So the Quaker women's meetings evolved or came about really with the through the influence of George Fox, this early Quaker leader, and his wife, Margaret Fell, and she's often attributed to having a really key role in the development of the women's meetings. It's accepted that some kind of women's meeting had existed really from the movement's beginnings in the 1650s in London, and it had existed essentially as a means of supporting the families of persecuted Quakers. And so they would it was essentially a sort of charitable group that met together, I think, on a 2-week basis. But the formal structure of the women's meetings that you're talking about evolved in the 1670s. And I think it really was, in George Fox's view, necessary for women to have a space where they could discuss matters that were relevant to women, and to provide a means of supporting the female members of their community. And this is where the establishment of the women's meetings is quite a contentious issue, and that's both in Quaker history but also in the history of early Quakerism. In Quaker history itself, the issue for many early leaders was that this was essentially permitting women too much authority within the church, and that it brought up those old debates about whether women should be able to speak in church settings and have any kind of oversight in church business. But in early Quaker history, especially in histories about Quaker women, the meetings have basically been seen as a form of institutionalization for women. It's essentially putting constraining their public experiences by enabling them to do roles that were very much conventional to women, such as like the distribution of charity or overseeing domestic matters. And the chapter in my book really aims to reverse that and show that it is a very unusual structure within a religious society, and that's because these women's meetings were essentially semi-autonomous. So in the American colonies, as an example, the men and women would meet together and have a meeting of worship together. And then they would essentially pull down the shutters in the middle of the meeting house, and the two groups would then discuss matters relevant to one another.
And now, when you say pull down the shutters, you mean that literally, don't you?
I do, yes. Yeah. So in the American colonies, they had purpose-built meeting houses where they literally had shutters that would that they could pull in half for the men and women to meet separately. So in some ways, that idea of equality is literally inbuilt into the architecture of the Quaker meeting house. And then My chapter really then tries to explore and tease out how that meeting system is transposed into different regional contexts. So how say the tasks and activities that are undertaken in the women's meeting in Ireland or the women's meetings in England or in the American colonies differ from one another, and what types of authority evolve in those contexts. And the aim of the chapter was to pull out and tease out the differences of the Quaker women's meetings, but I actually found that overwhelmingly the activities that women's meetings were undertaking on both sides of the Atlantic were actually very similar, and that's the one really surprising finding from my study, was that despite the vast distance that was separating these groups of Quakers, and despite the fact that they had these very different political and regional and religious contexts in which they're operating, for what is a very informal movement, this bureaucracy of the meetings is actually remains quite structured and similar across the Atlantic. There were some differences that I found, and like you said, I found that the Quaker meetings in Ireland and also in England, I'd say, do scrutinise the lives of their members much more so in terms of undertaking visits to see how Quaker houses are decorated and whether they're plain and that they adhere to Quaker values of plainness, or how Quakers are dressed and what sorts of things they're wearing, and the meetings in Britain are much more likely to legislate against or sort of set down strict rules about what people should wear or how they should behave. Whereas I think in the American colonies, it's a much more sort of fluid and mobile structure. And the concerns of the meetings in the Americas is more how to is trying to regulate the members, regulate who is actually attending their meetings and who is leaving and who is marrying. So it's overseeing very similar things, but I think there's just more emphasis in different parts of Britain and the Atlantic on slightly different matters.
Hmm. Well, obviously, in a transatlantic history that covers 1650 to 1750, you're thinking about other questions of governance as well, aren't you, in the run-up to American independence. Your last chapter is about how Quaker women interact with those outside the world of the Friends. How did they deal, especially with the War of Independence, when the transatlantic seems in some ways to fracture?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question, and it's one that's surprising, because the expectation, I think, is that as America starts to separate away from its former sort of British past, that the Quakers in the Americas would be doing the same. And I think the real problem for the American Quakers is that they can't really support the war for independence, and that's partly because the Quakers are very strongly pacifist by this point in the movement's history. So there's a refusal to bear arms, but there's also a refusal to do anything to support the war efforts. So that would include like not paying like musters paying taxes towards the war effort, or being able to be mustered into the armies and things like that. And there's a really interesting paradox that whilst Quakers in the American colonies had largely lived quite peacefully, particularly in areas like Pennsylvania, they suddenly, with the War of Independence, they're suddenly become becoming ostracized and persecuted as they had been in the movement's very early years in England. And I think that what it does is actually the War of Independence actually reinforces the solidarity of Quakerism as a transatlantic movement. And Sarah Crabtree has written a really fantastic book called Holy Nation, and it's about the idea that Quakers start to invoke this idea of the idea that they are this diasporic, persecuted, separate religious community in very similar ways to the Jewish ideas. And so, yeah, so the War of Independence then starts to encourage like British Quakers to correspond with American Quakers and to encourage them to remain faithful to Quaker beliefs and values. And it also has the effect then of actually encouraging exchange between these groups rather than them sort of distancing themselves. So, yeah, so it's quite an interesting for the Quaker movement.
Well, Naomi, we've taken up a lot of your time today discussing this brilliant new book, Female Friends in the Making of Transatlantic Quakerism. Before we wind up, though, can you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, so my new project is broadly about female incivility in the 17th and 18th centuries. And in some ways, it's an outgrowth of the third chapter of my book, which explores the idea of friendship. And whilst I was writing that chapter, I was really struck by the lack of discussion, I think, about negative aspects of female friendship and female social bonding. And I think that that's partly an overhang of traditional gender histories of female friendship and female alliance, which tend to want to see women's relationships in very positive and supportive terms. So my new project is basically trying to explore the tensions within ideas about civility and politeness. And I am using this as a way of understanding how women actually really do experience sociability and how it has this kind of darker side to it. So I'm moving on, looking at different ways in which women might respond to incivility. So whether that's through, say, microaggressions like, I don't know, like refusing to go on a social visit or write a letter, to like more dramatic examples of violence or insult.
Fascinating. That sounds like a great project. For now, I'm going to say thank you for writing this book, Female Friends in the Making of Transatlantic Quakerism, 1650 to 1750, just published by Cambridge. And thanks, Naomi, for coming on to the show to talk about it. Thanks for your time and take care.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to everyone else for listening today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.